From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Full moon tonight. Later on tonight, does the heart have emotion? Here's what's happening. More than 675,000 people in the United States have died so far from COVID-19, according to Johns Hopkins University. That surpasses the estimated U.S. death toll from the deadliest pandemic of the 20th century. The United States in November will reopen for air travelers from 33 countries, including China, India, Brazil, and most of Europe, who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, according to the White House, easing tough pandemic-related travel restrictions imposed beginning early last year. This decision, announced by the White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Jeff Zients, marked an abrupt shift for President Joe Biden's administration, which last week said it was not the right time to lift any restrictions amid rising COVID-19 cases. Lava flowing from Spain's Canary Islands' first volcanic eruption in 50 years has forced the evacuation of 5,500 people, destroyed about 100 homes, but the streams were advancing slower than originally predicted. The flow of molten rock will not reach the Atlantic Ocean on Monday evening, as earlier estimated. Experts say that if and when it does, it could trigger more explosions and clouds of toxic gases. In February, Amazon announced that it would install cameras made by an artificial intelligence tech startup called Netradyne in its Amazon-branded delivery vans as an innovation to keep the drivers safe. As of this month, Amazon had fitted more than half of its delivery fleet nationwide with this technology. Six Amazon delivery drivers in California, Texas, Kansas, Alabama, and Oklahoma, and the owner of an Amazon delivery company in Washington, who said that rather than encourage safe driving, Netradyne cameras regularly punish drivers for so-called events that are beyond their control or don't constitute unsafe driving. The cameras will punish them for looking at a side mirror, fiddling with the radio, stopping ahead of a stop sign at a blind intersection, or getting cut off by another car in dense traffic. Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the internet. Lauren, what the heck does this all mean?
Well, what's happening is that Amazon is attempting, one way or another, to impose what they view as safety regimes on drivers. Obviously, when you have large delivery fleets, there are always concerns about, you know, the different skill levels of drivers and the amount of attentiveness and things like that. And I haven't seen, you know, the articles that are out right now are talking about a pretty small set of mm-hmm. users who are being quoted. So I haven't seen any large or even, you know, medium-sized studies at this point about this particular system. Clearly, if you're going to be using automated systems to judge driver behavior, and let's keep in mind, this is something that's going on with insurance companies, you know, just conventional auto insurance companies now, too. In much of the country, you can use an app in your phone or a device that plugs into the car, and your insurance rates will be altered, you know, based on how that system perceives that you're driving. I think they may not be used in California at this point. I'm not completely up to date on that. But the point is that when you're using automated systems, it's important that they work properly.
That's right.
Obviously. And so if you have a system, whether it's camera-based or using accelerometers or other kinds of sensors to try to determine whether a driver is behaving in safe ways, if it's not working properly, or if the kinds of false positives you mentioned, certain kinds of things with stop signs, and I was reading about something that said you get cut off, and the system says that you were following too closely. Well, those are all kinds of things that a properly designed system should be able to differentiate. And if there's false positives, then you would hope that there would be an appeal system that would look at the data and be able to determine where there were those errors. So to make this work properly, obviously you have to have equipment that properly senses what's going on, and it has to be reasonably accurate in determining when there are situations that are the driver's fault versus not their fault. And in those cases where there's an argument about that, there needs to be a mechanism for appeals that actually works and isn't just a sort of fake appeal system. If it's not real, then drivers are going to be pretty discouraged, obviously. And if you don't have all of those factors, then the system probably isn't quite ready for prime time yet. And it'll be interesting to see when there's more information about this particular system as to how well it actually works. Because, again, I have not seen any real details yet in terms of the actual large numbers of drivers that there are about how well this system works in practice. It may have lots of problems. It may actually be very good and need tweaking. It may be somewhere in between. We just don't know.
Love your technology reports, Lauren. Lauren's website, Vortex, VORTEX.com. NASA is sending a robotic rover to look for water ice near a crater at the moon's south pole. In 2023, the golf cart-sized vehicle will land near the western edge of the Nobile crater, a 73-kilometer-wide depression, which is almost permanently in shadow. The Viper mission, as it's called, will support plans for human exploration of the moon again because the ice could be mined for use as drinking water and rocket fuel. What else is going on in the skies? Time for Stephen Cates, Dr. Sky. Hi, Stephen.
Hello there, George. We begin with space. It's jam-packed with information. Last week, there was a brand-new record set for the total number of people in space. Last week, for a brief period, we had 14 people in space, 7 on the International Space Station, 3 on the Chinese Tianhe module, and the soon-to-be-expanded Tiangong Space Station. And then those 4 lucky people, George, the civilian astronauts on the Crew Dragon Resilient spacecraft. But going back to the Chinese Tikonauts, as they call them, returned to Earth on September the 17th and soft-landed in Mongolia after setting the longest-duration space mission for Chinese Tikonauts. The robotic cargo ship known as Tianzhou 3 will launch today to resupply the Tianhe space system that's being built into a space station. And then a new crew on the Shenzhou 13 will launch in October. They have a very aggressive space program. With regard to the ISS, George, the total time, crew time on board, is now well over 7,627 days. And finally, a safe return of the 4 civilian astronauts that we talked about on SpaceX Dragon Resilience mission with a splashdown very close to the launch site in Florida. So space is obviously getting to be a very busy place. We shift to astronomy rapidly. More evidence, George, of something tugging on the orbits of outer bodies and Kuiper Belt objects. This elusive Planet 9 or Planet X continues to surface in the astronomical community. Recent studies show that there may be a larger-than-Earth object, obviously lurking out deep within the Kuiper Belt, larger than the Earth, and orbiting the Sun once in some 7,400 years, closer than originally thought, and making it theoretically brighter than expected for advanced telescopes to discover. And with the advent of these new high-resolution telescopes, the mystery of this planet may be discovered very soon. Stay tuned. George, the obvious part of the live sky, as you mentioned before, tonight, the beauty of the full harvest moon in Pisces. Tonight, rising here in Phoenix, it looked like this giant, amazing sliced pumpkin in the sky, now gliding across our skies. The moon, right now, some 242,760 miles away from your eye, or if you could travel on a light beam, it would only take you 1.3 seconds away. If you're wondering when the closest the moon will get to us, at least in this particular century, mark the date of November the 26th, 2034. The moon will be some 221,489 miles away from us. And right now, for people in South America, like in the nation of Colombia, the moon would be nearly overhead in the zenith. But, George, finally, the moon's diameter is interesting. It's quite small, 2,159 miles across. It's as if you took a flight from New York City to my home base here in Phoenix. It's actually that small. To learn so much more, we always recommend theskylive.com. Emails, we love them, drskyshow@gmail.com. The understatement of the century, always what? Remember to keep your eyes to the skies. I'm your navigator on the highway to the heavens. Thank you, George.
Thank you, Dr. Sky. We'll talk to you next week. Up next, the world's most famous hacker joins us as we talk about protecting yourself next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Kevin Mitnick back with us after a couple-year hiatus, the world's most famous hacker, and now a top security speaker. once one of the FBI's most wanted because he hacked into 40 major corporations just for the fun of it, the challenge. Kevin is now a trusted security consultant to Fortune 500 and governments worldwide. Kevin and the Global Ghost team now maintain a 100% successful track record of being able to penetrate the security of any system they are paid to hack into using a combination of technical exploits and social engineering. Kevin, welcome back, my friend. How have you been?
Great, George. Fantastic to be on your show again. Yeah, you're right. It's been about 2 years, and today I'm in Auckland, New Zealand. So a little bit of a time shift, but it's 5 p.m. here on what day is it? On Tuesday. So yeah. So I don't know where you are physically.
I'm in LA right now, and it's 10:19 p.m. in Los Angeles.
Fantastic.
Well, let me
good to hear your voice. I'm excited to be back on the show.
Lots to talk with you about, but I want to get your initial reaction to a fellow who'd been on our program before. He did our Beyond Belief television show as well. He was a software developer, came up with the antivirus, John McAfee. They claim that he killed himself in a jail in Spain waiting on U.S. tax evasion charges. His wife, Janice, said he did not commit suicide and his note was forgery. Just your take. Did you know him at all? Did he ever cross paths with you?
I talked with him a few times on Twitter publicly. I never had the opportunity to meet him. It is suspicious, George. The reason it's suspicious is, yes, he was facing some serious federal charges, but under the federal sentencing guidelines for tax evasion, it really goes to what is the loss to the government. And I remember the loss, I think in his case, would have pulled like maybe a potential 4 to 5 year sentence. So for someone to kill themselves when they're facing 4 to 5 years is highly suspicious, unlike Jeffrey Epstein, who was facing life in prison. So, you know, no one really knows the truth, but it is very suspicious, and I think it should be investigated.
Interesting take. He was a strange guy, I have to tell you, Kevin. On the times that I met him, a nice guy, but very, very strange and weird when it came to certain things.
And yeah, the guy had no filter on Twitter. I mean, I used to monitor his Twitter account mostly for the humor, because it was like he was out of his mind. And just the crazy things he did. Like, I remember him doing a video on Twitter about, being a fugitive in multiple cases. And in one where he was suspected of murdering his neighbor in Belize.
In Belize, yeah.
Belize. And then when he was running from the government, from the IRS, and talking about it on Twitter. So, yeah, the guy is... Yeah, he's kind of a loose cannon. I'm sad to hear that he passed away. He was an icon, obviously, in the computer security industry. And it's just a shame. It's just a shame that it ended this way. And, again, I think it should be looked into closely. You never know if another prisoner killed him.
No, you don't know. In 1987, he wrote the first commercial antivirus software program, sold most of his business for hundreds of millions of dollars, and apparently was flat broke.
Yeah, I don't know how you can go through hundreds of millions of dollars. I think you said hundreds or a hundred.
Hundreds.
I think it was $100 million.
At least.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what he spent his money on, or if he did really bad investments. But it's quite a shock to lose $100 million. I got to say.
Well, for the new people joining us who don't know who Kevin Mitnick is, tell us how you became as famous as you are.
Well, you know, as a young kid, I was really fascinated with magic, and I liked magic so much. I used to hang out at the magic store in Canoga Park, which is a suburb of Los Angeles, you know, for hours and hours and hours to learn the secrets to these tricks. And then my mom at the time was a single mother. She couldn't afford to buy me any of these tricks. And so fast forward to high school, I met this kid who could do magic with the telephone system. He was involved in this phone freaking. And at the time, I used to be a prankster. I used to love pulling pranks on friends and family. So I became involved in this hobby called phone freaking. And when I got into this hobby, I learned how to manipulate the telephone system. And one of my favorite things to do was to change a friend's home phone to a pay phone. So whenever his parents tried to make a call, it would say, you know, please deposit 25 cents.
Jeez.
So And my friend used to call me, change it back, I'm going to get grounded. And I change it to a prison phone, collect calls only. But I got really deeply involved in a telephony, in amateur radio, which is ham radio. And I just love I love learning about these new things. And then eventually I went into computers. And the reason I got involved in the computers was actually to increase my ability to manipulate the phone system, to pull pranks and to do crazy things with Ma Bell. So that's kind of how I got started. It wasn't about hacking for profit or deploying malware on the victims' computers and or trashing their systems. It was all about the intellectual challenge, the curiosity, and the seduction of adventure.
What got you, Kevin, into starting to hack into companies and their security systems?
Oh, because I wanted to get into the phone company systems, because if I had access to the phone company, I could control my friends and family's telephone lines, mainly in the Los Angeles area. So that's kind of how I got started with computer hacking, is really targeting the phone company, because I was like in a hybrid state at that time. I was into phone freaking, which that sounds weird. What's phone freaking? Phone freaking is kind of exploring the telephone network and trying to figure out things you could do with the phone systems, like identify secret phone company test numbers. Like, I remember when I was a kid, they had a thing called the loop around, George. And the loop around was a secret phone company test line. And how you could use it is you can call in on one phone number and another friend could call on another number. And these numbers usually ended in 1118 and 1119. And then you'd be magically joined so you could talk. So you didn't have to give out your phone number to any of the fellow phone freakers. You could just give them this loop around number and you could communicate. So it was very interesting as a youngster exploring the telephone system. I mean, I was just fascinated with it as a young kid, and I wanted to be able to do things like if a friend was talking on their phone, I wanted to be able to, pop on in, like how busy line verification. What that is if you remember the old days, you had an emergency and somebody was, on their telephone line and you'd get a busy signal, you can call the operator and she could bust in the call and say, oh, I have an emergency call from blah, blah, blah. So we were able to get access to these phone company test trunks and just drop in on conversations of our friends and say, hey, what's going on? And they'd freak out because how in the heck are you intruding on my conversation sort of thing? So it was always, in the beginning, it was always about pulling pranks and just doing crazy things with the phone system that kind of, amaze people. It was kind of like taking the magic, taking this technology and manipulating or hacking and doing things you weren't really supposed to do, but it was all for the reason or for the purpose of doing kind of like a magic trick with the phone company.
At what point did the FBI get involved and start hunting you?
Well, once I got into hacking, I didn't stop. I started this back, George, in 1978.
How old were you
they
then?
Past the 16.
Okay, geez.
And they didn't pass the first computer crime law until 1984, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, first federal computer fraud statute. And I got involved in hacking really when I entered into the first programming class in high school. So one kid that I met in high school said, hey, Kevin, you're so interested in this phone freaking and this ham radio. You might be interested in taking a computer class. And at the time, I wasn't so interested. But I went and met the computer science instructor. And the guy started grilling me. He goes, are you a senior? No, a freshman. Have you had trigonometry? No. Have you had calculus? No. Have you had, all these different courses? No. And he goes, oh, I'm sorry, you don't meet the prerequisites. You'll have to try back maybe when you're a senior. So then my friend goes, show Mr. Chris what you could do with the telephone system. So I started showing this guy, this instructor, all these different hacks. And he walks me into the computer room, and they actually have a phone there. And that's what they used to dial up to the school's computer at the time. And there was no telephone number on the phone. He says, listen, can you get me the phone number on this phone? Because I want my wife to be able to call me. So, of course, I knew the secret number that telephone company technicians knew. It was called ANI. Called this secret number, got the phone number for him. And he was like so happy. He goes, you know what, Kevin? He goes, I'm going to waive the prerequisites and allow you into my class. And George, I'm sure he regrets that decision today. And then And then the first programming assignment he gave us was to find the first 100 Fibonacci number. So it was to write a Fortran program. And I was thinking, you know, that's not so interesting. I want to do something that's a prank, that's magical. So my first program...
Hold on for a second, Kev. We're at the break. We'll come back and pick it up, and then we'll get into things where you can protect us from getting hacked. Well, you techies, we'll take your calls with Kevin Mitnick next hour here on Coast to Coast. We still have lots to talk with him about hacking and protecting yourself when we come back in a moment. And welcome back, George Norrie with Kevin Mitnick, as we talk about security, cybersecurity as well. So, Kevin, at what point did you realize the FBI was looking for you?
Oh, well, it's a long story, George. I mean, I wrote about this in my book, Ghost in the Wires, which is my memoir.
Yeah.
You know, and it's lots of pages of description. I discovered that the FBI was looking for me when I learned about an informant that they were using to try to pretty much coax me back into hacking at the time that I pretty much stopped. And there's a funny story is where I set up this early warning detection system where I was monitoring the control channel of the cell site in Calabasas, California, where I was living at the time. And I set up a system that if any of the phone numbers belonging to the FBI squad, and that was the white computer, the white collar computer squad mm-hmm. 3 in Los Angeles, anytime they'd come into my location, it would set off an alarm on my computer.
Wow.
So later on that day, I go to the office. There's a loud beeping from my office. I go to my computer alarm tripped that there was an FBI cell phone in my location. And I was able to get their cell phone numbers, but it's too long to describe the process for this interview today. And what I discovered is the FBI happened to be at my apartment surveilling it, you know, several hours earlier when I was sleeping, and I actually went to the office, and I realized they were there not to arrest me, but they were there to get a search warrant, because when you get a search warrant, you have to write a description of the premises mm-hmm. searched and mm-hmm. a bunch of other stuff to serve a judge. And then I realized what was happening, so that evening I went and cleaned out anything to do with my computer stuff, put it over at a friend's house. Then I went to the Winchell's Donut House down a few miles away, purchased a dozen donuts, and on the box, I wrote a Sharpie, and I wrote on FBI donuts, and I put it in the refrigerator. And then the very next morning, they raided me, and they didn't find any computer equipment. And then they never went in the refrigerator till the last moment, and they went in the refrigerator just to see if I hid anything in there, and they saw the box that was clearly marked FBI donuts. So they clearly knew that I knew they were coming, that's so they were funny. Pretty upset about
did
it.
Did they eat the donuts?
So the type... No, they didn't have one. No, but they were pretty upset, obviously. But that's because I knew I was a target, and I set up the system to look for their devices. Because at the time, I had complete control of the phone of the cellular phone companies in Los Angeles, and also Pacific Bell and General Telephone. So I was pretty adept at hacking those systems and being inside those systems so I could use it for intelligence gathering, which is really monitoring the people that were trying to put me in jail. It was pretty stupid back then to get involved in this activity, but, you know, I was much younger and much not as smart as I am today, and it just happened, and that's how I discovered, you know, that they were coming to get me, is through monitoring their movements through their cell phone.
Kevin, I want to talk about individuals and how we can protect ourselves, and then governments and what's happening on that front. But in terms of ourselves, there's so many scams out there. I'm going to just tell you one thing that I almost got caught on. I had an email from what I thought was my bank, and it said, you know, we have reason to believe that there might have been a breach. Please, you know, link into this website and put in your password, blah, blah, blah. And right before I was going to do that, I said, this is kind of weird. I looked at the email where it came from, and it had the name of my bank, but it had this gobbledygook URL address that made no sense, like xyzpwxy@. And I said, that's not my bank. What do these people want?
They want your login password so they could log into your bank and steal your money. That's what they want. So what you described, George, is a typical phishing attack, which is very common today, where bad actors will send what we call, these are, this, you know, the term, this computer security term is called credential harvesting, which really means to steal your password. So they'll send these emails that purport to come from your financial institution, your brokerage, and it will come with a link, and usually they'll have a good excuse for you to click the link that they hope you'll fall for. And then when you click it, it wants you to log in, you know, to put in your credentials. So beware, you know, all the listeners that are listening to the show today, anytime you receive an email and in the email you click a link and it wants you to put in your username and password to anything, step back and think about it before you follow through, because you might be the victim of a phishing attack.
How did they know that was my bank, or was it just random?
It could be random, or, you know, there's literally hundreds, if not thousands, of data breaches that are going on. And these data breaches are published in these, what we call, like, hacker forums. And there might have been some breach that you might have been contained in that gave them that intelligence that you banked with this particular financial institution. And to describe the power of these data breaches, think about all the sites that you use on the internet. And if you're not using a different password at each site, that you're doing a lot of password reuse, that bad actors could search these data breaches, find passwords that you've used before, mm-hmm. that you might be using somewhere else today,
right.
or even the pattern that you pick. So, George, I looked you up in a data breach, and I'm not going to, you know, give this information over the air if you don't want me to. But, for example, I see, you know, several different passwords that you've used when you use the george@coasttocoastam.com email address, which may or may not belong to you. I assume it does, but I really don't know. Would you want me to just say a few of these passwords I see?
No. Brother? Don't say it on
okay.
the air. They might be the real thing.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened to Colonial Pipeline. And you remember they were the victim of a ransomware attack.
Right, for bitcoins, right? Yeah.
Right, for millions of dollars of Bitcoin. And how the bad actors got in the first place was finding a password in a data breach. And then that password, even though it was old, still worked. And it allowed them to VPN into the company, which was to connect to their virtual private network.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to deploy their ransomware. And ransomware is like a huge problem today for businesses around the world, and it's billions of dollars of income for the bad actors. These bad actors are charging ransoms in the tens of millions of dollars. And the intelligence is that a lot of these ransomware groups are based in Russia, and they actually have companies, you know, with a, you know, HR department, you know, they have a full IT staff. Probably the employees of the company don't realize they're working for a business that defrauds people and it's committing crimes. And they could afford to have a full staff. And what they're doing is they're offering the service in what we on the dark web, which could be accessed through this thing called the Tor browser, but it's like a special part of the web, let's say. And they're offering this thing called ransomware as a service. So you have these amateur hackers or fraudsters, rather, and they're able to get the ransomware program, let's say, to run on a target's computer. And when they deploy this program, what happens is the victims send in the ransom to the company that developed the ransomware, which is likely based in Russia and other, and you know, could be anywhere,
right.
but a lot of these groups are in Russia. And they take 30% and give the bad actor 30%. So it's almost like Apple's App Store model fraud, where
they do give them a cut, though.
Yeah, like 30%. Well, they take 30% and they give the bad actor 70%. It's the same model as Apple in their App Store. When you
Incredible.
Publish an application, Apple takes 30% of the take. It's the same model.
Okay.
So they're using this ransomware as a service model. And this type of crime has exploded and is affecting so many different companies around the world. And it's a big problem that we're trying to solve today.
How about these data breaches that have been happening to T-Mobile, Facebook, LinkedIn, and those companies?
Yeah, and so these data breaches are kind of a mixed bag, George. You have some where they accidentally configured their infrastructure, and it could be a database of, say, customer information could be public, but they don't even know it. It's through a misconfiguration on their part. It's not that somebody aggressively tried to break into the company. You could have an employee that had a laptop stolen out of the vehicle, and the information on the laptop was not encrypted, so that's a way of leakage. And the other most likely way in is where you have these bad actors break into the business, and once they get in, they deploy the ransomware. And you know, the number one way that this is the number one way that the bad actors are infecting businesses is through phishing attacks, the one that you just described a moment ago. But rather than when you click the link, it goes to a web page to put in your credentials, it does something else. It deploys the payload into the system, or gives the bad actor access to that network where they're able to deploy the ransomware. And and pretty much after that, the company is probably going to have to pay to get their data back, or they're going to have a good backup and restore process in place so they could restore from good and trusted backups because their data is likely going to be encrypted.
Countries like North Korea, Russia, China, Iran, what are they up to in terms of hacking?
I wish I knew. every country, George, even the United States,
we all have
offensive capabilities. Yeah, we all have offensive capabilities at Cyber Command where we're attacking other countries. I mean, the tools that were used in some of our cyber attacks were actually published on the internet, you know, a while back, several years ago. And at the same time, we have defense. So every country is trying to hack each other, and they're doing a pretty good job at it. I'm pretty confident that we have foreign actors in our critical infrastructure in the United States. You have China, which steals our technology. Rather than being innovative and inventing new technologies, they basically hack into innovative companies in the United States and steal the technology. It's much easier than developing it. So that this problem is going to continue because countries are pretty much immune from prosecution. It's quite interesting that the Department of Justice, in a few cases, put out, you know, they actually indicted some bad actors out of Russia and China with a wanted poster, and they indicted them for computer fraud and abuse and yada, yada, yada. But there's no way they're going to actually be able to try those people or get them into the country because they're actually part of the military. They're part of military operations for these foreign nations, and they're certainly not going to, you know, extradite their foreign military to a country like the United States for prosecution. So it's almost like a big waste of time, and I don't understand why our tax dollars are wasted, you know, actually writing up an indictment and publishing a wanted poster for the, you know, Chinese military. It's kind of ridiculous.
Edward Snowden, is he a hero or a criminal in your mind?
Well, I'd rather categorize Edward as a whistleblower.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, mind you that, you know, what he did was illegal. That's obvious. He did it, you know, we all know he did it because he believed the government was going too far and spying on, you know, us. And it was, you know, in breach of our constitutional rights.
And he might have been right.
Federal statutes. But at the same time, no, he was right, 100% right. But at the same time, you know, there's this issue of whether those any of those documents he gave to any of the journalists, did that contain any of our U.S. operations against foreign adversaries? Like, I think I remember reading that we compromised Angela Merkel's cell phone in Germany. And that intelligence was discovered through the Snowden docs that were given to the, you know, given to journalists. So I question whether, you know, that was legitimate, because here we are, you know, we're obviously, like I mentioned a moment ago, you know, we're hacking foreign nations, and here we have one of our trusted security analysts giving that information publicly to a journalist. So, you know, it's kind of, I can see both sides. I think whatever president in power should give him a pardon and let him come back to the United States and be productive, rather than having him just sit there in exile in Russia.
Yeah, they should tap into his brain.
They should actually use him to help the country and help help America. Because don't forget, the government works for the people. And if the government was crossing the line and violating our rights, I believe we had a right to know. I absolutely appreciate Edward Snowden's revelations there. And I think the government, rather than leaving him in exile in Russia, in a foreign nation, or trying to prosecute him and throwing him down a deep, dark hole for the rest of his life, that his talents could be put to good use to help the country.
I think you're right, too. Do we all have the capability, and we being a planet, of tapping into everybody's utilities, shutting them down, shutting down water supplies? Does every nation have that ability?
I don't know about every nation, but you think about this, George. Everything is controlled by a computer.
Everything.
And
everything.
I believe everything. And every computer, in my mind, is hackable, especially when you're dealing with critical infrastructure that's not part of Department of Defense. Even systems that are on air-gapped networks, and air-gapped means there's not supposed to be any network connection. But if you recall, the United States and Israel had a joint operation. I think they called it like Project Olympia or Olympics, but it's what we know as Stuxnet. And they were able to destroy physically the Iranian technology. I think the centrifuges is there. I'd have to reread the documentation. But they were able to, through deploying malware, even though it was on an air-gap network, to destroy their technology.
Fascinating work. Kevin, we're going to take a quick break and come back and take phone calls with you. Where are your books? Are they still available?
Yeah, absolutely, on Amazon. My favorite book is Ghost in the Wires, because it's my memoir. And it's, 400 pages of, crazy stories. Maybe even more crazier than John McAfee, George.
Yeah, maybe.
It's more crazier than that guy. And then my last book was called Art of Invisibility. It's really kind of the subject of the show, how normal consumers like you and I, George, can protect our privacy. So those are the two books I'd recommend. Of course, I have Art of Deception and Art of Intrusion, also that's available on Amazon. But again, my favorite is Ghosts in the Wires.
And the website, mitniksecurity.com, still functional?
Yep, hopefully, unless somebody's doing a denial of service attack right now. It's www.mitniksecurity.com.
We're going to come back and take calls next with Kevin Mitnick on Coast to Coast AM.